From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the military medium should be fascinating. Here's what's happening. A French drug maker has been found guilty of aggravated deceit and involuntary manslaughter over a weight loss pill at the center of a major health scandal. The drug is called Mediator, was developed for use in overnight diabetics, and was on the market for 33 years. It was eventually withdrawn in 2009 over concerns that it could cause serious heart problems. Hundreds of people are believed to have died as a result of that drug. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, during a White House briefing, has warned of impending doom amid a recent increase in coronavirus cases and related hospitalizations. Walensky appeared on an ability to hold back tears as she expressed concerns that the U.S. could soon bear witness to a fourth surge, even as the country has averaged some 2.7 million vaccinations over the past week alone. The U.S. in recent days surpassed 30 million cases of COVID-19, and she is really scared. But you know what? It could be just overhyped, too. It turns out that you don't have to live in the city that never sleeps, New York, to be an American suffering from sleep deprivation. A new study reveals that less than 1 in 10 people actually feel rested after sleeping. Are you one of those? A survey of 2,000 respondents finds that, on the average, Americans only get 5 hours of sleep every night. More than 6 in 10 people cannot remember the last time they had a full night's sleep. Visa has said it will allow the use of the cryptocurrency to settle transactions on its payment network. It's the latest sign of growing acceptance of digital currencies by mainstream financial industries. That's kind of fascinating. AT&T is lobbying against proposals to subsidize fiber to the home deployment across the U.S., arguing that rural people don't need fiber and should be satisfied with internet service that provides only 10 megabits of upload speeds. Let's check in with our expert on such matters, Lauren Weinstein. What are they opposed for, Lauren?
You've heard me express my concerns about AT&T in this respect before. The basic problem is that they only want to build these systems where they think they are going to have lucrative profit potential.
Uh-huh.
Where the people are that can pay the big money for them and hopefully bundle in other services and all of that. They just haven't been interested in putting them anywhere else, and of course, rural areas are at the very bottom of their interest list. And when you hear them say, yeah, everybody should be fine with 10 megabits a second upstream. Yeah, okay. Well, you know, it's not, 2005 anymore. People are dependent as much on upstream as they are on downstream now because so many people are working at home, and that's going to be a permanent aspect of our lives now to an extent that's going to go forward indefinitely. And of course, school from home is still going on. So it's just amazing to see them, take this point of view. And as you and I have discussed, I've been fighting with them for years trying to get fiber where I am, even
sure.
though it's very close by. And I'm in a suburban area. I'm not in a rural area. So you can imagine the situation for people in those rural areas who have to depend on sketchy cellular or, there are some satellite alternatives, but they're expensive and they have their own limitations. And after all the years that AT&T was promising widespread fiber deployments and getting all kinds of breaks as a result of those promises, it's clear now that they just don't really have an interest in fulfilling those promises and that service isn't on their mind anymore.
What about competition that comes in?
What's that word again? Competition, right? As we've talked about, in this country, there is almost no competition for wireline services. The country has been divided up into fiefdoms by the cable companies and by the phone companies. There is tremendous resistance to overbuilding, which is when you have competition, like if you had two cable companies or two phone companies in an area that could actually compete and bring prices down. They don't want that. They don't want overbuilding. And it's completely different than, for example, in Europe, where the government mandates that these basic telecommunications features like fiber have to be available mm-hmm. to everybody. And everybody still makes a profit, and the services are layered on top of them. But we've let these companies, these giant telecom companies, have it all their own way all these years, and that's put us behind basically the rest of the developed world.
Lauren, thank you for finding that story for us, by the way. That story we've been talking about the ship that was blocking the Suez Canal, costing billions of dollars every day in shipping, that ship called Ever Given has now been refloated. And the Suez Canal is now open, finally. It's a colossal container ship that had blocked the Suez Canal for some time now. Our friend and mentalist Uri Geller is taking some credit for this because he did a mind experiment to get the ship to float, and it did. How about that? Spending very long periods of time in space has something in common with extreme endurance swimming. Both can cause the heart to shrink. That's the conclusion of a study that compared the effects of an astronaut, Scott Kelly's year in space, with a marathon swimmer. How about that? Earth is completely safe, they say, from any potential calamity causing asteroids for the next 100 years, according to NASA. Let's hope they're right. What else is going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. Wow, some more information on these stories that you're reporting. An earlier Drudge headline today, Supermoon Saves the Suez, naturally talks about the importance of the pull of the moon and then what it has on the Earth with the tides. And this large mega ship that you were talking about, the Evergreen Ever Given, naturally was refloated after being stuck in the sand in the important shipping lane, the Suez Canal, for nearly a week. And, George, a combination of human effort and the rising tides brought on by the recent full super worm moon actually helped to make this possible. This is interesting. We can see how astronomy plays an important part, especially in this situation. The full worm moon, George, occurred on Sunday at 2:48 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time and is going to be closest to us at some 223,000 miles as we move into the 30th. This was the fourth closest full moon of 2021. And the high tide that helped to free the Ever Given is known, George, as a perigean spring tide. Supermoon, going back to that, is 14% larger and 30% brighter than a regular full moon. And then more information on what NASA just talked about. And NASA's made a bold statement, George, as you talked about, saying that the Earth will be free from any non and now known asteroids, I should say, from hitting us for the next 100 years. And this goes back to the April 13th, 2029 passage that will occur, the large 1,200-foot-long asteroid known as Apophis, which will graze the Earth by only 20,000 miles. They say we should be safe, and also during the next passage in 2036 and 2068. That's the good news. And, you know, it's interesting, George. We were passed by one of the largest of the near-Earth asteroids, 2001 FO32, on March the 20th, by about some 1.3 million miles. But the good news ends there, as many astronomers still believe that there are chances for some new asteroids to come in from the region around the Earth's orbit from behind the sun, as we can't see them maybe until it's too late. And once those get too close, like the 2013 Chelyabinsk object, well, with bigger and better space cameras, we hope to track those too. We end off with the live sky. Now, folks, as I'm standing out here live in my Phoenix skies, a post super warm moon tonight, George, waning gibbous moon. It's moving into April, the last quarter moon, on Easter Sunday. And the moon will be close to Jupiter and Saturn, a beautiful set of conjunctions coming up low in the east before dawn on both April the 6th and the 7th. As I'm standing here, George, Mars is still high in the west, now 161 million miles away from us. Jump on the light beam. It'll take us only 14 minutes to get there. And if you look high into the northeast sky, right around 10 p.m., right around showtime here, you'll see the fourth brightest star in the sky. It's called Arcturus, 36 light years away, incredibly 25 times the size of our sun. Email me, love those, at drskyshow@gmail.com. More information always, George, at theskylive.com. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies, and I'm your navigator.
on the highway to the heavens. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. The full moon was just gorgeous last night. You can still see part of it tonight. And it's just great hearing your reports, my friend. Up next, we're going to talk about Planet X. Doug Elwell back with us on Coast to Coast. Get ready for this incredible story. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Our webmaster Lex Lonehood has posted several pictures that Doug has supplied us. Go take a look at them. They're up there at coasttocoastam.com. By day, Doug has worked in the field of information technology as a freelance website developer. By night, he moonlights as a travel writer focusing on mysterious and exotic travel destinations around the world. Doug's book, Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age, has just come out with an updated version, reveals his hidden passion as an advanced theoretical theologian focusing on retranslating the Bible in light of the modern scientific advancements. Doug, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, thanks so much for having me back on again.
We just had that story where NASA is telling us that over the next 100 years, we don't have to worry about asteroids. What bothers me about that, Doug, is a lot of the asteroids that they tell us about have already passed the planet. They catch them later, not before.
Right. The asteroids are so dark, they actually have a dark organic material on them, which makes them very difficult to spot using normal telescopes.
Absolutely. How have you been?
I'm fine. I'm doing well. I just started my own publishing company, and I'm starting to publish independent books, including republishing my book on Planet X. And I just started working on my book on the Giants again after several years focusing on my web development career. Now I finally have some time to focus back on doing books and the kind of stuff that the Coast to Coast audience likes to read.
So that means we're going to get you back again, right?
Hopefully at the end of this year.
Super. Good for you. Planet X, what got you interested in that? Of course, we know the work of the great and late Zechariah Sitchin.
My original interest in Planet X, so I was looking for signs of Jesus' second coming back when I was in college, and I stumbled upon this the passage in Matthew 24. It's called the Olivet Discourse, and Jesus was basically describing to his disciples what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age. And in Matthew 24:30, he described this mysterious sign, which was so terrifying that the entire earth would be terrified by its appearance. And so I was trying to figure out, there's all kinds of false prophets and false starts and bad prognostication that's been going on for centuries. So I figured that this heavenly sign would be a sure sign that would tell us for sure if Jesus was actually coming back. And so I underwent, while I was at college, I was going to Southern Illinois University, and he had a very nice library there.
In Carbondale, right?
Yeah, in Carbondale, right. I got a degree in
civil. One of my granddaughters is going there working on her pilot's license.
Oh, yeah, they have a good school down there.
Yeah.
A roommate of mine actually got his license there as well. It's a very good school. I really enjoyed my time there. It was actually, the great thing about it is actually you could go out to the outskirts of the town at that time and actually see the stars really, really well. You can actually see the Milky Way. It was still fairly rural back then. And so I had some really nice experiences doing stargazing. And it also really helped out with my understanding of astronomy while I was looking for this heavenly sign. And I studied the subject. And for some reason, I decided that the Star of Bethlehem was kind of the same object. And so I said, well, Jesus was preceded by a heavenly sign in Matthew 2 called the Star of Bethlehem. Maybe this is the same or a similar sign returning again in the end times. And so I kind of looked at the Star of Bethlehem and the various theories regarding that. And there was a number of different theories, but they really boiled down to three different ideas. It was either a supernova, a comet, or a conjunction of planets. And even though all three of those have their strengths and weaknesses, none of them really fit very well because supernovas only last for a few days. And the Magi, who were basically Persian astrologers and wise men, would have to travel probably several weeks, if not months, from Persia to Israel to actually be able to witness the Christ child, give them the gifts. And so that didn't really work out. Also, comets are relatively transitory. They only last a few weeks, and they're usually often not very bright, and they're relatively common. I mean, you have a few dozen significant comets every century, so there was nothing really unique about a comet. And also the conjunction of planets, which is probably the most popular one. That is probably, there were no significant conjunctions around that time, and the conjunctions typically only last a few days, once again not long enough for the Magi to follow it all that way from Persia down to Israel. So I wasn't really satisfied with all the answers they were giving me, so I kept looking, And I kind of broadened my search to, you know, fringe theory and outside of the Christian community. And I came across this book by Zechariah Sitchin called The 12th Planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so in his theory there was that there was another a planet in our solar system which came and went over thousands of years. His orbital period was 3,600 years based on the Sumerian Shar measure. And he believes that Planet X comes into our solar system every once in a while as far as the asteroid belt, where it originally conflicted with the Earth, which it actually formed not where it is presently, but actually in the asteroid belt. And this conflict with Planet X, which was a new planet that came into our solar system from outside, possibly captured from another solar system or maybe a rogue planet. And what happened was one of its satellites collided with Earth, and another of its satellites pushed Earth to its present location closer to the sun, where it could be warmer and it could sustain life, because where it was in the asteroid belt originally was too far away from the sun to support life. There just wasn't enough sun. It was much farther away than Earth in its present location. And so I felt that that was an interesting theory, and it also answered a lot of questions. How can you have a bright star or planet that comes and goes over thousands of years, and maybe every couple of thousand years returns to herald a new age of mankind? And I thought, you know what, that fits the Star of Bethlehem idea perfectly, because if the Star of Bethlehem was an appearance of Planet X, the Planet X would come back sometime in the future as a sign of the Son of Man. So I've been pursuing that idea, and I found that it fits not only the end times and the nativity, but also the creation. Answers a lot of questions about all three of them.
And it does wreak havoc when it comes around, doesn't it?
Well, what happens is, even though it doesn't actually come too close to Earth, its perihelion, or the closest approach to the sun, is actually in the asteroid belt, which is pretty far away from us, so we're relatively safe. But it becomes very prominent and very bright when it enters into the inner solar system, because it has not one but three comet-like tails which form when it enters, when it passes by Jupiter, and the solar wind begins to ignite the water that has circulating around it. And basically, the theory is it has a huge amount of dust and rocks and water and gases in orbit around it that was left over from that original conflict with Earth, and it remained in orbit around Planet X. So not only is that how it forms its comet-like wings and tail, as you can see in the Sumerian images of it, where it's like this cross-like object which has these huge wings and a tail. It also is screened by all this dust and rock, so we cannot see it at all until it gets close enough to the sun so that the wings and tail are sublimated due to the solar wind. And we can see it. Not only can we see it, it's extremely bright and very, very obvious. But the real threat from Planet X is not Planet X itself, even though it's possible that it could have its orbit altered sufficiently so it could come close to Earth again through interaction with the outer planets, because it goes in and out of our solar system and passes by the outer planets and sometimes interacts with them gravitationally and sometimes catastrophically. But the greater threat is actually the huge amount of asteroidal material, it's large and small rocks, it carries with it in its orbit. And when it comes into the inner solar system, a lot of the stuff gets scattered around. And Earth, every 2,000 years or so, appears to experience large, massive impactors from huge asteroids that strike all over the Earth. And the most recent time that happened was actually around the time of Abraham in 2000 BC, which probably explains not only the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah by fire from heaven, but also there's an impact crater from a large asteroid in southeastern Iraq that was discovered back in the 1980s, which explains why the capital city of Ur, or capital city of Sumer, named Ur, was actually destroyed by, in their mythology, they feel that the gods had thrown down fire from heaven to destroy Ur. And we now know that was actually an asteroid that struck near there in the marshlands near the Gulf. And as a result, all of Ur and many of its surrounding regions were totally destroyed by what we now know as an impact crater from an asteroid, or impact from an asteroid.
It's amazing, Doug, how many celestial events have been turned into biblical events.
Well, the Bible actually records a lot of them, but a lot of them we don't have recordings of. There may have been many asteroids striking and destroying many civilizations over time. We just don't know about it because they weren't recorded. All we see are the craters, and most of the craters we probably haven't even discovered.
I mean, the Great Flood could have been a tsunami, right?
The Great Flood was probably a combination of asteroidal impacts and tectonic shifts due to possibly asteroids striking contrary to the Earth's rotation and actually dislodging the crust temporarily so that the Earth actually rotated back, rotated backwards or stayed still for a period of time. That would have caused massive tsunamis because that would have caused the waters to slosh over the Earth as they continued to move while the Earth's crust stopped, slowed down, stopped, or possibly even reversed. And so you'd have a great flood because there's going to be huge walls of water traveling hundreds of miles inland and basically covering everything.
Doug, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, including giants and the riddle of the Sphinx, when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Doug Elway with us. We'll take calls, like I mentioned, next hour with Doug. Doug, in Zechariah Sitchin's book, 12th Planet, not only does he, as you mentioned, talk about Planet X, but he talks about the fact that it's inhabited by a race called the Anunnaki. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm actually leaning more and more towards the idea that there was a kind of a Star Wars type of conflict in space in ancient times. It's a question of whether or not they're extraterrestrial biological entities or spirits who have created bodies for themselves to inhabit while living in the material world. It's really a question of worldview. I mean, you have ancient aliens, which proposes the ancient astronaut theory, which is possible. I myself, as a Christian, believe more in the idea of spirits creating bodies for themselves so they can interact with the material world. But in either case, there was a schism, a civil war between two factions, one which was greater and one which was lesser, which is described in the Bible as kind of the a war in heaven, and specifically in Revelation 12, where the leader of this rebellion, who was named Satan or the dragon, was thrown down from heaven to earth, and all of his forces, those angels who rebelled against the high God, were thrown down with him. It doesn't really say where this happened or where he fell from, but it is entirely possible that the battle was for the control of Planet X, and Satan and his forces lost, and they ended up being thrown down to Earth, where they remain to this day.
It is exciting, though, and the possibilities are just amazing, aren't they?
We really could be dealing with a Star Wars type scenario. It's really quite breathtaking, the potential of what these discoveries are bringing us.
Doc, tell us about your work with giants.
Well, back about 2003, when I was still publishing Mysterious World, mysteriousworld.com, I was actually inspired by Steve Quayle and his writings on the giants.
Uh-huh.
I was looking for ideas for articles for Mysterious World. And so I ended up writing a series of articles about the giants, based partly in his work and that of some other things, and my own study of the giants and the fallen angels, which were interlinked in the Old Testament, specifically in Genesis 6, but in other places too. I'd actually had a master's degree in Old Testament biblical studies, and I studied much of what is called the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Old Testament written by Moses, and they were kind of a cohesive unit. And they talked a lot about the battle with the giants and this thing called the iniquity of the Amorites, and how fallen angels were apparently coming down, intermarrying with women, and creating these giants. And so this was not only interesting personally, it was actually part of my faith journey. How is this possible? What does this mean? And so I determined that most likely what it was is these rebel angels we were talking about previously had come down to earth and intermarried with the women that God had created, and were creating a race of giants in an attempt to, which would be a biologically, genetically enhanced humans, in an attempt to retake heaven, whether that is Planet X or some other location in some other dimension. And so the theory is that, and this is part of my book on giants, is, you know, not only what were the giants, but why did they exist? What was the purpose of them? And part of the reason the giants were created was to help Satan and his fallen angels retake heaven away from God and basically rule the universe. So I'm exploring that idea in the book. So it makes a lot of sense because the giants were given what we understand as high technology. Adam and Eve, actually, in my opinion, when they were tempted in the garden, they were actually given a knowledge of what we understand as the arts and sciences and technology. They were educated. They were no longer ignorant. They were educated, probably extremely brilliant, you know, genius level beyond mm-hmm. Einstein. And so the theory is that Satan was actually tricking them into creating their own, technological prison, where he would teach them how to build this technology, but then he would use that technology to control them. Maybe sounds a little bit familiar. And so the idea is that it's a technological bluff, as Jacques Ellul would put it, one of the people I studied in grad school, is that the technology that enables us will eventually allow Satan to control us. that's the real danger. The advantage of technology can also be a disadvantage because it can also be used to control you by sinister third parties who do not have our best interests in mind. And so that's always been a struggle between a technological approach and the reliance on God for your provision. Since the garden, a man has struggled between, I want to be technologically advanced and be able to do lots of great stuff, or I just want to keep life simple, live in the wilderness and, farm or something. There was the classic clash between Cain and Abel. And Cain, who learned how to use weapons.
Brothers, right?
Brothers, yeah, two brothers who with two different ways of doing things. Cain turned on his brother because he was jealous because God preferred his offering, and he killed him with technology, a weapon he had created. And so that was the beginning of the schism between the two great lines, the line of Cain and the line of Seth, with Seth being the next son who replaced Abel. And so that was a conflict between those two. And you see this in the Bible. You have the line of Cain talked about in Genesis 4. And then you see the line of Seth falling through to Abraham. And there was a constant struggle between the two, all the way up to the flood, where the giants, who are descendants of Cain, actually defeated the descendants of Seth through a combination of war, attrition. They outbred, they outcompeted. And they stole all the resources. Wherever giants went, they would basically take all the resources and not replenish anything. They were completely non-green, whereas the sons of Seth were highly green and were meant to keep in balance with nature. Satan had designed the giants to conquer and control and take control of nature, and there was no concern about the replenishment of nature. It was all about conquest. And so eventually the giants had built their weapons and possibly even what we would call high-technology weapons, even by modern standards, because the fallen angels probably could have taught them practically anything. What happened is there were wars that are so devastating, they actually polluted the earth. And so in order to get rid of the giants and everything they'd done and all the pollutions they had created, the technology that was basically leading to the enslavement and destruction of the human race, God sent the flood and saved eight souls out of that, eight souls from the descendants of Seth, according to the Bible. And put them in the ark, and they survived onto the next world, whereas the previous world was destroyed by the flood and everything about it, except for the occasional out-of-place artifacts we find.
Right. There's apparently a skeleton found in a cave in Afghanistan, according to Steve Quayle. I interviewed the pilot years ago. It's a strange, strange story. But does that tell us then where the giants went? They were just all obliterated in a flood?
That's the story we were told, that some other stories escape, or some of them managed to escape, and some people think they actually made it into space and are maybe colonizing planets as we speak. I mean, we're talking about very advanced beings, people who are kind of like us, except probably smarter and more aggressive. Think of Khan from Star Trek II. That's basically what the giants were. They not only did they not want to give up, they could not give up. They were designed to be obsessive, compulsive, attack psychopaths, basically, that had constantly attacked and never forgave and never gave up. And that's why they had to be destroyed, because they were designed to destroy everything around them except for themselves. And ultimately, in their psychosis, they ended up destroying themselves too.
Now let's talk a little bit about your work on the Riddle of the Sphinx. You did that in 2012. What is the Riddle of the Sphinx?
The Riddle of the Sphinx is a very interesting little story. It actually comes from the play Oedipus Rex. And the story, the hero Oedipus is returning to the city of Thebes, and he's met on the way by a sphinx, which is basically the head of a woman with the body of a lion and the wings of an eagle, and it swooped out of its lair in a cave in the rocks and told him, you can pass if you can tell me the answer to my riddle, otherwise I will devour you. And the riddle was, what is it that walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three legs in the evening? Do you know what the answer is?
Me? No, I do not.
Okay. The answer is man, who crawls along on four legs as a baby, two legs as an adult male, and three legs as an old person with a cane.
So a cane. Okay, right. Interesting.
And so that by itself was interesting, but what I determined after my study of the Bible is I was thinking, this sounds kind of familiar. And I looked back at some of the prophecies, and the prophecy of Judah it's Genesis 49:9, when the patriarch Jacob, when he was dying, and they were living in Egypt, and the 12 tribes were about to inherit from him, he gave prophecies about what would befall them in the end times. And the prophecy regarding Judah, the descendant, you know, the progenitor of the Jews, said that, it says that, if I could quote this, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down. He couched as a lion and as an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? And I realized, you know, that has the same kind of situation where there's three ages of man, except it's like three ages of a lion. And the Sphinx was like part lion, part man. And now we have Judah being described as part lion, part man as well. And he's also talking about a lion's whelp, which is a young lion. Couched as a lion as an adult, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? And when you're talking about couched as a lion, you're talking about the Sphinx, because the Sphinx is known throughout Egypt as being this great lion, which crouches on the plain of the Giza Necropolis. And I think my theory is, in the book, is that they're talking about something that is buried underneath the Sphinx, and they're identifying exactly what will befall Jake or Judah in the end times, is that he will go to the Sphinx and he'll find what's buried underneath it in the secret chambers. And
and they have found the chambers. They just haven't told us what's in there yet.
Yeah, and they know the chambers are there, but they have not been allowed to find them. I suspect it has there's a very powerful technology from the world before the flood, possibly a number of different technologies, including what we would call optical hard drives made of sapphire, which contain all knowledge from the world before the flood.
And what about renderings for the Great Pyramids? Do you think that could be in the Hall of Records there?
It is possible there's things hidden in the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids, actually. Great Pyramid, we know, above the Grand Gallery or near it, there's actually a large space that sonar has discovered. It has been undiscovered. It's a huge space. It looks like a large storage area that's probably containing a lot of artifacts that will tell us a lot about our ancient history, possibly from the world before the flood, because some people think the pyramids are actually built before the flood and survived it, because there's actually water damage in parts of the flood.
That's right.
They've been around for a long time, long enough for there to be water in that region, which is not since before 10,000 B.C., which was around the time of the ending of the last ice age and the probable time of the Great Flood.
Robert Schock was on our program last week, and he was, of course, one of the originators of that theory.
He's done an amazing job of really, really doing a thorough analysis of all the geographical elements. And that discovery regarding the water erosion was a masterpiece that really revolutionized our understanding of the Giza Necropolis, specifically the Sphinx. And it was quite obvious, if you look at it now, that there was a very large amount of water erosion over thousands of years. It's not something that could happen accidentally over a short period of time. That required a very ancient age for the Sphinx and a lot of rain over a long period of time, proving absolutely the Sphinx and probably the pyramids and the Sphinx temples and all the rest are many thousands of years older than we think they are, and from a different era and a different history than we've been told.
And what are your thoughts on end times as it relates to all of this, Doug?
One of the theories I had about the Sphinx was that it was actually the great red beast of Revelation. One of the reasons I came to that conclusion is that the Sphinx, as we know, has had its head recarved several times, at least once, because right now its head is about maybe a third or one quarter the size that it should be proportionally. It's basically a pinhead on top of a full-sized lion body. And my theory was, when I was trying to figure out what was the dragon of Revelation 17 and 18, is that the dragon was actually, it was said to have seven heads and ten horns. And when I was looking at the Giza Necropolis from above, I realized there was exactly ten pyramids in the Giza Necropolis, which looked kind of like large horns. But also, where to get the seven heads? My theory is that the seven heads are actually seven heads of seven kings over time that have been recarved from the original large head of the Sphinx. It got smaller every single time until the last of the kings, which is number six or seven, is actually the last in line, or this maybe number six. Number seven might be the Antichrist, or maybe number eight. It's not clear. But my theory is that they're actually, John was actually talking about the Sphinx when he was talking about the great red dragon. And there's other reasons for that, is that the dragon was said to come out of the earth. The Sphinx is actually in its Sphinx enclosure. It looks like it's actually crawling out of the earth, because the enclosure is actually beneath beneath the waterline, or very close to it. So the Sphinx actually is kind of beneath the level of that area. It looks like it's crawling out of the earth. And the Sphinx was also originally painted red, just like the Red Dragon of Revelation was. And so we actually have a number of different coincidences here, kind of matching up with the Giza Necropolis, which I've always felt was important to the end times intuitively. And so the more I study this location, the more I realize this might be Revelation central in terms of activity in the end times, including some very important high technology and secrets that have been hidden there since the flood.
Is it conceivable that the Egyptians have already burrowed down into that Hall of Records at the base of the Sphinx and just never told us what's in there?
I suspect that there is something so dangerous down there that they have decided not to do that.
But they know what it is.
I think there are secret societies that have been guarding that for thousands of years who know exactly what's down there and are preventing anyone from finding it until the time prophecy is sometime in the future. I think the Antichrist will actually discover these artifacts, and it'll make him so powerful he'll actually be able to defeat, it'll help him conquer and control the entire world.
My God. And you think that whatever is down there might have been used before?
I think that the things down there were so powerful and so dangerous that they were purposely kept hidden in a very difficult way to find.
ET technology?
Yes, actually. Nephilim technology, fallen angel technology, ETs. Technology that's so powerful and so dangerous that mankind must not be allowed to find it.
And they just decided to hide it down there at the base of the Sphinx.
It's too useful to destroy, but it's too dangerous to let loose, so they kept it under the Sphinx and probably some other places around the Giza Necropolis.
Wow, that's kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, it's apocalyptic. I mean, if the people who get a hold of this stuff, if it is what I think it is, they literally would be invincible.
We're going to come back in a moment with Doug Elwell and take phone calls with him. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We shall chat about Planet X, Giants, and the Riddle of the Sphinx as well. So jump on board. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Doug Elwell. We'll take your calls when we come back.